racist who wore a Hitler-style haircut and mustache to the riot on January 6. Co-workers say he made frequent anti-black, anti-Semitic, and pro-Nazi comments while working as a security contractor at the U.S. Naval Weapons Base in New Jersey. The U.S. government plans to house up to 3,000 immigrant teenagers at a convention center in downtown Dallas as it struggles to find space for migrant children. According to FEMA officials, the convention center in downtown Dallas will house boys ages 15 to 17 to free up space in Border Patrol detention cells that are holding record numbers of unaccompanied teenagers and children in deteriorating conditions. As of this weekend, some 4,200 children are being detained in overcrowded Border Patrol facilities. Some of them have reportedly been held for a week or longer, forced to sleep on the floor, unable to shower, and were not allowed to call their families to alert them of their whereabouts. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas defended the administration's handling of migrant children. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 44 degrees and cloudy. In New York City, it's 35 degrees and also cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Mara Evering.
The time now is 1 minute past 3 p.m. Stay tuned for Black Star News with Milton Alamadi. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Our enemies are many, and they stand ready to pounce upon and exploit our every weakness. They prey upon our vanities and flatter us in every kind of way. They tell us that this particular person or that particular country has greater or more favorable potentialities than the other. They do not tell us that we should unite, that we are all as good as we are able to make ourselves once we are free.
Greetings, sisters and brothers. Welcome to Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM, New York. I am your host, Milton Alamadi, and what you just heard from there was a brief clip of Kwame Nkrumah, a speech from the 1960s. And with me today to discuss Kwame Nkrumah's relevance and how important his blueprint for Africa was is Brother Kambale Musavuli. He's based in Ghana. He is a Pan-African, an internationalist, an activist, and a great believer in the power of the Pan-African vision of Kwame Nkrumah. Welcome to Black Star News Show.
Thank you for having me.
Very good. So we can take it from any angle, actually, because I'm looking at what Nkrumah really said. And we are still realizing that 50 years after his passing, joining the ancestors, that when it comes to Africa, and I say Africa because that's my vision of Africa as well. Africa being able to protect its sovereignty and to use its vast mineral and natural resources to create prosperity for Africans rather than having the multinational corporations coming from the West to exploit Africa's resources. And now China as well. Everybody benefiting from Africa's resources except Africans. I don't see any better vision than what Nkrumah outlined for Africa. So please, take it from any angle you like, Brother Kambale.
Nkrumah never dies, as many Nkrumahists say here, because beyond what he wrote, we are actually living some of the realities and projects that he built that are still relevant to today. You know, Nkrumah is the only head of state in Ghana who has had over hundreds of factories built. He actually built over 700 factories in Ghana. Any president after him combined never built anywhere close to 700 factories. He completely transformed and rearranged how things were produced in Ghana. Today, as we look at what is actually happening, it's almost as it's a deliberate attempt to erase Krumah's relevance in the lives of Ghanaians, in the life of Africans, but for people not to actually know who he what he did. So I'll give you an example. Today in Ghana, the history books that students learn in sixth grade in Ghana says that Kwame Nkrumah was a dictator. Now, this is not a rumor. This is not something being shared on social media. This is actually fact, because there is a debate since this information has been shared across the country. How is it possible that the history book that young Ghanaians are learning in the sixth grade says that, one, he was a dictator, two, that his political party, the CPP, wasted money supporting Guinea, another African country, rather than using the resources in the country, and so many other falsehoods. Whenever the Minister of Education and anyone around the Ministry of Education was pushed to answer to this question, the Minister of Education, the Deputy Minister of Education, says that he was not aware this was actually happening, and that it's actually happening outside of a mandate or an order from the Ministry of Education. That's the current reality at the moment. And there is, as I mentioned, there is a debate around that. But if we look at what he did, he builds roads. When you're in Accra, you just look at the road that takes you from Accra to Tema. This road was built by Kwame Nkrumah. He created the cocoa board to be able to produce cocoa and for Ghanaians to benefit from it. The exploitation of the resources, particularly gold, to take the proceeds of that to build the factories, to transform the educational system, to send many Ghanaians around the world to get expertise outside and inside, and using Ghana as the beacon of hope for Africa's independence. People forget, in the late 50s, Ghana became almost the capital of Africa's revolution.
Right.
Who did come to Accra? You had Fanon there, you had Du Bois there, you had Padmore, you had revolutionary leaders of Africa coming to Accra. You had actually bases, right? Military training bases for African revolutionaries fighting for independence right here on the outskirts of Accra. So this beacon of hope was stopped, and they tried to destroy it in 1966. Where they try to erase the history of what Africans were able to build for the first half of the 20th century. But today, as you and I are speaking, we are able to rediscover this history, not just because we are able to find the books where this information is located, but those who were alive then, those who fully participated in Nkrumah's vision of a United States of Africa, are still alive and are speaking and are sharing the knowledge with the hope and conviction that we will be able to achieve the vision of a United States of Africa. We will be able to achieve the objectives of the 1945 Manchester Conference, the Fifth Pan-African Congress that took place in 1945, and we will be able to free Africa from the shackles of neocolonialism and neoliberalism that we are facing today.
All right, so Nkrumah built the Volta Dam, the river project, which provides up to date tremendous electricity, electric energy, hydroelectric power for Ghana and some of the regional countries. And as you spoke about the factories he built, he wanted to use that as an example of how Africa must industrialize so that we use our raw materials to build resources, to build products in Africa rather than selling it cheap to the West. Yeah. And in 1959, if you look at even the World Bank statistics, Ghana's per capita income was about $190. At that time, China, the People's Republic of China, per capita income was 89. In other words, Ghana was practically double that of China. I mean, look where Ghana is today and look where China is today. And I say this to say, if the entire continent had actually pursued Nkrumah's vision and we had realized a United States of Africa, where would Africa be today? I want you to address that, but I also want you to tell listeners who may be confused, why would the current government in Ghana want to rewrite Nkrumah's history and legacy? What benefit could it derive from rewriting that history? Many listeners might find this very confusing, so please explain.
Ghana's position of the 1950s, as I mentioned before, is that it was literally at the center of many revolutions that was going to radically transform Africa. Kwame Nkrumah taking power in 1957 as the first head of state of Ghana, he had a clear mission that this is now a liberated zone, and let's support our brothers and sisters across Africa to achieve that vision. And many Africans who interacted with him actively, not just passively, who even came to the Pan-African Conference, the All-African People's Conference that took place in 1958, understood that you could come through Ghana and have the resources to transform your country. I just had a conversation last week where I found out that the former ambassador to Ghana, of Ghana to Cuba, actually facilitated Che Guevara's trip to Africa from Havana. Mm-hmm. And he came in Accra, met people here, and then later made his way to the DRC. Now, when you hear these type of stories, that you understand why, when there was a coup in 1966, you know, one of the decrees that came out of that coup was that they made Nkrumah's book illegal. They were burning books written and writings written by Nkrumah, and the archives are there to make sure to erase that from the collective memory of Ghanaians so that they will not understand the achievements that Ghanaians, Africans of the time made from 1945 to 1966. It was a revolutionary period. Now, fast forward to today, when we hear, when we see the current government, as you say, it's a confusion for many, because when you look at Ghana from outside, you know, you have the impression this is the home of Kwame Nkrumah. Things are going well, and they are you know, wonderful. There is a wonderful history, a legacy of Kwame Nkrumah that Ghanaians should uphold. Mm-hmm. That is not the reality from the government's perspective, for example. If the curriculum that's being taught to Ghanaians, the young Ghanaians, that what they teach them in school is that Kwame Nkrumah was a dictator who wasted money to support other African countries, this is a right-wing coup of Ghana's history and Ghana's future. Because the youth of tomorrow will not understand why African countries are independent today. They will not even understand why the Organization of African Unity today, called African Union, exists. What were the mechanisms that young Africans put together for us to be where we are? And it would be very easy for young Africans to say, our foremothers and forefathers are the reason why we are in turmoil today, we are not able to advance. When it's a concerted effort to destroy the legacy, the history, so that we do not know how they invaded our countries, they killed our leaders, they transformed our education system so that we can recover from that. So that's what I said. The second one that I always share with people, when you fly to Ghana, you are welcome at the airport. The airport in Ghana, we Nkrumahists call it the Accra International Airport. But the world knows the airport as the Kotoka International Airport. And no one asks the question, who is Kotoka? Mm-hmm. Kotoka was one of the soldiers who participated in the coup against Kwame Nkrumah. So imagine You fly into Ghana in an airport name after the person, one of the soldiers who did the coup against Nkrumah. And there has been a deliberate attempt to erase the history and legacy of Nkrumah, that if you are not living in Ghana, you will not know this is happening. This is why I've been sharing with whoever I have access to, like, what is actually happening, because it's important is for Africans to know this is happening, because I'm sure the same thing is happening in many countries around the world. If you go to Kenya trying to find the history of the Mau Mau, probably you won't have the true history of that. In the DRC, I know for a fact that to have information about what happened to Patrice Lumumba, you will never get that information for Congo's history books. I learned more about Lumumba outside of the Congo than when I was studying in the DRC. So whenever we see that, we must denounce it. We must grab our history, relay back proper, and explain why we need that to change. And I will end by speaking about the reality of this week. The Ghanaian government published their budget for 2021. The analysis of the national budgets is whenever you see even the way of thinking of the budget, you see that we're in trouble. Half of the budget is actually to be spent on paying interest rates of loans. Half of the Ghanaian budget today is that. And the other half is funded by a $5 billion loan they're going to get from international funders, mainly the World Bank, who is putting the country in more debt. And this 5 billion Ghana cedis in local currency, about $1 billion or so, that they're going to be borrowing, the generation of the future will continue to pay. So while discussing with some of the Ghanaian scholars and economists who believe in the vision of Nkrumah, and ask them, but how would you do it different? The comment was simple. It's like, come on, this is a question of just rearranging production. We don't need the loans. So we have mineral resources. People think about oil, they think about gold. So that we don't even talk about spectrum, an essential mineral that Ghana can develop on. Ghana has a lot of spectrum. Ghana has cocoa. So what we must do is what Nkrumah started doing successfully. We needed to find out what resources we have. We need to change how we produce it. As we produce our own resources for our own need, take the proceeds of those resources and then use those proceeds to transform the society by addressing the fundamental needs, the basic needs of the society. So that's not rocket science. So it means that the government does not have a development plan. Kwame Nkrumah had a 7-year development plan. The documents still exist. I said, where is the development plan of today? So whenever they have a budget with so much loans in it, it's clear that whenever the economy crash, they will call the so-called Bretton Woods institutions who gave them the same money to come and restructure how the economy and production takes place in the country. And that's the challenge of today for young Ghanaians and for young Africans, to not get caught up in what some of the Western economists tell us about what production should be. We know Kwame Nkrumah was able to achieve it. 700 factories built under his rule, supporting other African countries who saw themselves attacked by France, particularly Guinea, and providing them loan to be able to stand up in their own feet. Providing scholarship, providing support, funding the Organization of Africa Unity. We're just talking about gold. So we know we have the history of transforming how production is made, but we must reclaim that history to be able to succeed in 2021 as we're moving on into the future.
And have the courage to do it too. So listeners, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Black Star News Show on WBAI New York 99.5 FM radio. I'm your host, Milton Alimadi. My guest today is Kambale Mustavuli, and he's based in Ghana, in Accra, a Pan-African internationalist. And we're discussing about the everlasting lessons of Kwame Nkrumah, Ghana's first leader and perhaps one of the greatest Pan-Africanists to have ever lived. Listeners, you can only hear this kind of discussion on WBAI, as you know, and you can only do so because we are entirely commercial free. We are supported by listeners such as you. So to continue making that happen, I do remind you, please pick up the phone, be generous. Times are hard, but whatever you can contribute will allow us to continue this work that you enjoy and learn from. Dial 516-620-3602. Any contribution we will put to good use, I assure you. Or adopt Black Star News Show at a buddy, meaning the money is taken out of your credit or debit card on a monthly basis. You can do that by going to give and then the number 2, WBAI.org. Now back to my guest. So, Brother Kambale, is it also the S word that Ghana fears, as do many African countries? Because Nkrumah was, of course, a proud, avowed socialist. And that perhaps was one of the reasons why the United States participated in the coup d'etat that overthrew him in 1966. Nkrumah's vision is clearly articulated in his book, Neocolonialism, The Last Stage of Imperialism. And listeners, I encourage you to order that book. It will teach you so much about Africa and the world in general, in terms of how the Western world also works in undermining Africa. And that book is available on Amazon. So, Brother Kambale, would you like to talk about that for a little bit?
There is no other options when we're looking at the ravage of capitalism, not just in Africa, around the world, but to change the way production is made on the African continent. I am actually a very strong supporter of Nkrumah's vision because it makes sense. You can teach it in villages to people and explain them why there is no other way. European countries and Western, the U.S. and others, when Africans look at them, you show up in New York City or Paris or London, you see these buildings. You say, man, I wish our countries had these nice buildings. But what is not mentioned whenever you see that is the capital to build these countries came from somewhere. 400 years of free labor. Human beings were killed. They were put into boats in inhumane conditions. Millions arrive across in Europe and in the United States. And they worked for free for hundreds of years.
And millions never arrived.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's how they accumulated this wealth. For people to be able to see the so-called White House, for people to be able to see everything that we see. So when we want to develop on the African continent and we look to these countries and we see what they've done, are we saying that Africans should go somewhere and catch slaves and have them work for free for decades and centuries? Where will we catch the slaves? One, as Africans, this is inhumane. This is not our nature. We cannot do that. That option is not available to us at all. So Nkrumah says, if we cannot develop the way they did, because it's not sustainable, it's not humane, and the option is unavailable. But we just look in our own land. Say, in our land, we have gold, we have diamond, we have copper, we have cobalt, we have oil, we have all these resources. But who owns these resources? Then he discovers that the Ghanaians did not own the wealth. Britain controlled the wealth. Go to the Congo, Belgium controlled the wealth. Go to Guinea, the French controlled the wealth. So it became clear that we can't catch the slaves and we don't control our resources, that the only way is we must regain control of our land and resources so that we can exploit our resources for the benefit of our people. There is no other option. I have not heard anyone who has made any sound explanation to me How can Africa develop if they can't control their own land and resources? So that's the African way. If the African way is called socialism, I'm a proud African. Because there is no other way for us to develop but to gain control of our land and resources. And that scares Western nations. And that should say something about them. If they are afraid of us developing to have better schools, better roads, better education, by just exploiting our own resources, what kind of human beings are they? Are they interested in humanity? Because that should be the question. The question should not be, is this socialism that's scaring them? No, they're scared of humanity. They're scared of humanity being able to fulfill its potential, and a potential where no children, no child will go hungry. No mother will cry because their children have been massacred in wars. No parent will have to bear the brunt of suffering every day to see the children go to school. That every human being on the African continent will be able to fulfill their strong desire of a very fulfilled life with all the opportunities that they have, thanks to the resources that they have. That's why they are scared. They're not scared of the S word. They're not scared of socialism. They're scared of humanity being able to live peacefully and gracefully and achieve its potential while they use another methodology of exploitation and degradation, environmental degradation, and so on. So Africans must wake up. It's not by accident that Cabral was also a strong believer of Marxism, socialism, communism. Not by accident that Du Bois, who many people study in university in the United States, but they don't tell them that this man was actually a member of the Communist Party, he actually won the Lenin Prize and came. He did not just speak about change. He actually worked with the Nkrumah government as an advisor to Nkrumah, and he was part of organizing all the Pan-African Congresses to bring other Africans together. And the fifth Pan-African Congress, which we base our mobilization on, is one of the most important and fundamental conference that liberated Africa. In the fifth Pan-African Congress in Manchester in 1945, young Africans from the United States, the Caribbeans, continental Africa, and some who were already living in Europe, came together at the end of World War II in October to denounce the contradiction that, one, these European nations are going to war. After World War II, they still have colonies. That it does not make sense. And two, that the immediate tasks of Africans in 1945, after World War II, was to liberate the African continent.
That's right.
From 1945 to 1960, they achieved the immediate objective of getting at least 12 African nations, and that wave spread across the continent. It is now upon us to continue that fire, to transform Africa so that we can have the United States of Africa as we all wish, so that Africa can rise and take its rightful place in history.
Listeners, we now take a midpoint break, and we will be back shortly with the second half hour with our guests.
This mid-20th century is Africa's. This decade is the decade of African independence. Forward then to independence. To independence now. Tomorrow, the United States of Africa.
Our sisters and brothers, welcome back to the second half hour of Black Star News Show on 99.5 New York FM WBAI. I'm your host, Milton Alimadi, and our guest today is Brother Kambale Musavule, and he's based in Accra in Ghana. We now continue our conversation. I like what you said about Du Bois and his contributions. And many listeners are not even aware that Du Bois is actually buried in Ghana, because toward the end of his life, he relocated to Ghana and he did some work on the Africana. Was it the Africana Dictionary?
Mm-hmm.
The encyclopedia, correct? He's buried in Ghana. But I also like the other thing you said in terms of the West being scared of humanity, scared of a world where there are no people to exploit. And that's very interesting. You put it very well. But then the other side could be also scared of a world where an empowered Africa may start demanding for justice and actually being in a position to make these demands heard. I'd like you to maybe address that briefly and also just give us your final assessment in terms of how the young generation in Africa can be encouraged to embrace the lessons of Nkrumah. And then after that, maybe we can discuss other parts of Africa.
I will try my best to fulfill that task. I'm quite passionate, and sometimes it hurts to see where Africa is, but it's encouraging when you see the movement of young Africans. You know, you look in Uganda, young Ugandans they stood up to a dictator there. They've mobilized through even the electoral crisis. They're still standing up. Hearing us, there are still some who are being arrested and hurt, but they are not remaining silent. I'm looking at Senegal. Young Senegalese are standing up. I'm looking at Haiti. Young Africans in Haiti are standing up. Right? So even though it may seem that we have a long way to go, but there is a desire in young Africans all around the world and people of goodwill all around the world to have a say in the future, in the way things are done that affect their lives. Some would say the decision-making process. But the fear that may exist for, let's say, reparations can be justified from the perspective of Western nations because they actually know the horrors they committed.
Right.
But justice is not negotiable. Even if it takes centuries, justice will always be served. It's the proper course of history that issues that has affected us will always come to the forefront to be addressed. So it can be addressed sooner, or if it is addressed later, it may be much more complicated for Western nations. But the people will always fight and demand justice, and they will seek through many means to gain that justice. But now on the African continent, there is a battle for the minds of the young Africans. Now, I remember, I'm probably speaking from a privileged perspective where I had the chance to be mentored by elders who helped me find answers when I did not have answers, direct me to what to read or mentor me. It's not something that's accessible to every young African. But young Africans know there is something wrong happening on the African continent.
That's right.
On March 19th, for example, March 19th here in Accra, the United States military is doing a military simulation with its military from Accra all the way to the Gulf of Guinea. Young Africans know this is not right. The Ghanaian military could never do its military simulation in Washington, D.C., the capital of the United States.
Right.
Right? So if it is happening on the African continent, those are the discussions I'm hearing among young Ghanaians. How is this happening? What can we do to transform our land? So in our work to seek answers, the gap becomes how do we connect the past so we don't make the same mistakes and we don't repeat the same tactics that will make us fail in some of the tactics that we may use. That's the gap where we believe we are the first one to do an action. We are the first one to mobilize. I mean, Kwame Nkrumah had trade unionists, and I'm finding that now. They were Ghanaian trade unionists being sent around Africa to work with African movements. They were great humanists just getting on the plane, Nkrumah say, hey, we need you in East Africa. Go to Kenya. And I found that one was one of the trade unionists. As I mentioned, I can't disclose that because now it is public information. Mm. He was the former Ghanaian ambassador to Havana. No, he was flown to Lisbon, flown back to Kinshasa, was arrested in Kinshasa in the 60s by the Mobutu regime, and Nkrumah had to engage. He arrested a few Europeans for Belgium and others, demanded that he is released. But his mission was to go work with the trade unionists and other activists in Kenya for the liberation of Kenya. Mm-hmm. So how did they build these networks when these networks did not have social media, did not have the Twitter and the Facebook? So what were the challenges that they faced so that we don't commit the same one? The second one is an ideological battle, right? Because we must be clear who we're fighting. We must understand what is imperialism and what is capitalism. When we understand what is imperialism and capitalism, in our strategy to mobilize, we'll be careful on who helps us. We'll be very careful when the U.S. ambassador is hanging around young Congolese youth, for example, in Kinshasa, and wonder, can the Congolese ambassador in Washington freely walk around Chicago and hang around American citizens without any repercussion, right? So we must also understand that if we're not paying attention about what's happening in Central African Republic, it will spread across the African continent like wildfire. And I'm saying that because as a young Congolese born and raised in the Congo, when I was 8 and 9 or even 10, I would watch Hollywood films. I would watch Chuck Norris.
Right.
Watch all these things. I never thought in my head that these wars that I was watching in Hollywood will ever happen in the Congo. Mm. I remember the Rwandan genocide. I was watching it on TV. We were a Zairean at the time, right, watching that 1.2 million Rwandans just cross the border of the Congo, and there was a humanitarian crisis. And we did not think that was the beginning, an opening of a Pandora box. So something that happened in Uganda, then in Rwanda, affected the Congo for over 2 decades now. So I'm clear, it's not just an issue on any African country. If any African is watching elections and see that there was a rigged election in Uganda and is not speaking about it, it's only a matter of time that you turn into Guinea and hear a rigged election in Guinea where Alpha Conde is still in power, and then turn on the TV again and wonder why in Cote d'Ivoire there is still an attempt to keep a president in power beyond constitutional term limits. And I will spray that the answer for the African youth is to say in 1945, young Africans had a common goal. The immediate objective was independence now. In 2021, my observation is that the fundamental issues of young Africans is that the African continent is young. The people who lead the countries have no interest whatsoever for the future of this youth or the interests of African people. That we need a second independence movement where each country, when people are mobilizing, no matter which country you are from, you are going to make sure that the voice of the people is heard in Mali, in Niger, in Uganda, in DRC. That we have to make sure that we don't have leaders like in Congo Brazzaville who are trying to run again. That our second independence movement of 2021 will make sure that no leader on the African continent is coming from the people, right? The leader who is elected must come from the people. If it does not come from the people, we will make sure that he feels the hell before he dies. That the African people are saying, we are tired. That in this time where China is saying that they have eradicated poverty, that we are still people starving on the African continent. That this makes no sense in 2021 when there is a world pandemic, that Africa has no capacity to make its own vaccine.
Yeah, so that's a crime.
Donated vaccine with all the intellectual. So that's the way I see the African youth mobilize now. We need a second independence movement, a much more radical movement where we as African people are going to take control, not just of our national boundaries, but our continental boundaries, because we are bound to one another for our future together.
Yeah, I like that about the need for a second independence. In fact, one might say that the first so-called independence was just opening of the door for Africans to truly fight for real independence. Because if you look at it carefully, the first independence was merely a transfer of power from the colonials to their new governors. In other words, many of the African so-called leaders now act, they take on the role of the former European governors and serve the interests of the West. But now that you also touch a little bit on East Africa, I would like you to explain in the clearest terms possible to American listeners how dangerous and destructive the Ugandan dictator has been, General Yoweri Museveni, who's been propped up by the United States taxpayer dollars for 35 years, and how destructive he's been not only to Uganda, to Rwanda, to Congo, to Central African Republic, and to South Sudan. Explain it in such a way that Americans can now think more carefully in terms of how their taxpayer dollars are being used.
In 1986, Yoweri Museveni of Uganda came into power in a coup, in a military coup. He was not elected by the Ugandan people. And I don't recall any year where the Ugandan people have been able to elect freely Museveni. He's been able to rule the countries from 1986 to now with U.S. taxpayers' money. He's received military support from the United States and the U.K. They've backed him. He served as their ally in the region to give them access to the Horn of Africa and also the DRC, particularly for the Congo, is for the mineral resources that the DRC has. In 1986, as he took power, he supported the Rwandan refugees who lived in Uganda, who also participated in the 1986 coup, particularly Paul Kagame of Rwanda. I mean, what people do not know, Paul Kagame of Rwanda was a director, if I'm not mistaken, of military intelligence of the Ugandan military.
Correct.
But as he was in Uganda, traveling with Ugandan passport, he was actually sent to be trained in the United States as a Ugandan soldier. He was trained at Fort Leavenworth. And then from 1990 up to the 1994 genocide, he, few Rwandans, and the Ugandan military invaded Rwanda, staged a low-intensity war, which escalated to a Rwandan genocide in 1994, where after 3 months of the genocide, they came and took power. But it didn't end there. Museveni, as you already mentioned, has engaged in conflict, in the destabilization effort, not just conflict, in South Sudan, in Central African Republic. But what is pertinent now is the destabilization of the DRC and the impact it had on the African continent. In 1996, Yoweri Museveni of Uganda and Paul Kagame of Rwanda put their militaries together and invaded the Congo in what they called at the time a Pan-African undertaking. They actually believed that this was a Pan-African invasion to remove a dictator. How do we know that this was not true? We know that in history, the United States has never supported the Pan-African undertaking. So the U.S. and the U.K. plotted to have a coup against Kwame Nkrumah. They're the one behind the coup. They've done everything in their power for the Organization of African Unity to not rise, which has had a clear position and so on. So when people saw a so-called Pan-African invasion of the DRC in 1996, the fact that the United States was supporting that invasion should have been clear to people. And this invasion came from a context where in the 1990s. Bill Clinton had a vision, the so-called Entebbe principles of the Renaissance leaders of Africa. And these Renaissance leaders of Africa were leaders supported by Washington at the time to serve Washington's interest. Those were Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, Paul Kagame of Rwanda, Meles Zenawi of Ethiopia, and in some extent, Laurent Kabila of the DRC, who came to the invasion. But the invasions of Rwanda and Uganda into the DRC in 1996 has unleashed death of Holocaust proportion since 1996 to the present. And this conflict hasn't ended. Over 6 million Congolese people have died in this conflict, which add to the numbers of the millions Ugandans killing in northern Uganda, which add to the numbers of the millions of Rwandans also who died due to these military operations of Uganda and Paul Kagame or Rwanda, and others who have died in Burundi. So we have millions of Africans who have died in the region over what? Shiny rocks, mineral resources that's used in our modern-day technology, displacement of villages, destruction of women, rape used as a weapon of war, and all of this in total impunity. Congo was able to sue Uganda at the International Court of Justice in 2005. The ICJ did found Uganda guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity in DRC. In order for Uganda to pay $10 billion of reparations for the crimes they committed. Up until today, the Congolese are waiting to collect this $10 billion that Yoweri Museveni of Uganda has refused to pay.
Now, before you continue, Brother Kambale, I would like to ask you just this question regarding that aspect, and then please do continue. Why, if the Congolese government is not interested in trying to enforce that judgment and seeking liens on Ugandan assets, for example, why can't Congolese citizens collectively come up with an organization and try to enforce that judgment, which is still valid and now with interest must be billions and billions more of dollars?
I do believe Congolese can do that. It's a question of organization. We do have a challenge, a lack of capacity of organizing meaningfully to be able to do that. I do think it's a brilliant idea. It's now how do we organize it successfully with the proper attorneys and allies and people who dedicate the time to do so. The right. Precedent is there. The judgment is there. The same narrative also can be put for Dan Gutler. I mean, the U.S. Justice Department just fined an American hedge fund over $200 million fine for corruption. But the fine is not going to Congolese. Mm-hmm. It's going to the collection of the fine is going to the Canadian mining firm, which organized lawyers to sue this American company in the U.S., and we've been talking to some of the young Congolese who are in law schools. I say, hey, we have these cases. What can we do? So it's just, unfortunately, a testimony of our lack as Congolese, our capacity to organize, to go after that, and also our lack of information for some or many Congolese that there is actually a court judgment from the International Court of Justice that we can use to be able to do that. So that's on the aspect of the ordinary Congolese.
Then your listeners, if you're just tuning in again, I'd like to remind you that this is Black Star News Show, WBAI 99.5 FM radio. I'm your host, Milton Alimadi. My guest is Kambale Musavuli. He's an internationalist, Pan-African activist based in Accra, in Ghana. I remind you, listeners, just one more time, support us in bringing these type of shows to you. So please do pick up the phone. Dial 516-620-3602. Any support we will put to good use, or adopt Black Star News Show as a buddy, in which case the money is taken out on a monthly basis from your credit card or debit card. You can do so by going to give and then the number 2 and then WBAI.org. Back to our guest. Yes, please do continue, comrades.
Yes. The second aspect, which is even much more critical, is Congolese are held hostage by the government. The government of the Congo does not represent the interests and the will of the people. I'm sure you've seen the president of the Congo traveling to Kampala, smiling with Yoweri Museveni, creating a project for Uganda and Congo to build a road from Kampala to some part of the eastern part of the Congo, and no discussion of the oil dispute in Lake Albert, no discussion around this ICJ court ruling. So one will ask, but why isn't the Congolese government putting pressure on Uganda? It's just to go back to the history of the past election that just took place. Congolese people voted for a leader. Whoever they voted for did not become president. And the person who was declared president is serving not the interests of the Congolese people. He's serving the interests of Washington, primarily Kampala in Uganda and Kigali in Rwanda. That's also why it makes it hard when even the Congolese government is not providing the support or the backing of following through the case that they themselves put at the ICJ. It was the Congolese government that went in 2005 for this case, but right now it's the Congolese government that's not willing to collect because they're not coming from the Congolese people at the present time.
All right, now we're going to run out of time soon. I would like you to offer any other comments that you have, and perhaps also you can, if somebody who's listening to this program, that person associated with the Biden administration, what message would you like them to convey? You can answer that, but you can also comment on any other outstanding issue, and we have about 3 minutes left.
I would be remiss if I don't speak about the challenge of Western Sahara. That's a struggle that we as Africans have to look at.
Yes.
One of the last remaining colonies that we have on the African continent. They are being colonized by Morocco, and their struggle is also important to us. For the Biden administration, Biden is very well aware of the DRC. Dr. Jill Biden, by the way, was in the DRC as the second lady. She traveled to the DRC, met with Dr. Mukwege, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, that was under the Obama-Biden administration. Right. So she's been to the DRC. They know the situation. The Congolese are clear in their demands right now. We want justice. We want an international tribunal for DRC. Why international? It's because many of the crimes taking place in Congo have been committed by people outside of the Congo. So we need international jurisdiction to be able to hold them accountable. The Biden administration cannot engage in these 4 years, or even eight if they are reelected, with the same Obama policy of lip service to Africans. If he says that he wants to stop corruption on the African continent, they have all the evidence possible there. Implement the policies. Stop supporting African dictators. Why is the United States supporting Yoweri Museveni or Uganda right now?
Right.
Why is the United States still supporting Paul Kagame or Rwanda? Why, in the face of a rigged election in the DRC, you continue to support that as well and trying to build a U.S. military base in Kisangani, in Camp Base? So breaking honestly, because Africans are not children. We know we know what is happening to us. We are tired of being killed for resources that is on our land. We want a new Africa. If the United States is going to be a fair partner, change your foreign policy. Stop supporting the so-called strongmen of Africa. Stop arming, equipping anyone on the African continent that's committing gross human rights abuse on its own people.
Right.
Because Africans understand it. When we see that, it's a contradiction to what they say. So you want democracy, but you support a dictator. How are we going to be a partner? But it's really in the end of Africans. We must demand more. We must transform Africa. We must rise, regardless of what Biden will do. But they can change U.S. foreign policy and stop supporting African dictators on the African continent.
In other words, we must make Black Lives Matter in Africa as well. So please tell listeners how they can get in touch with you if they want to continue this conversation.
The first stop is always friendsofthecongo.org. Friends of the Congo has done extensive work in documenting the information around what is happening in the Congo and launched campaigns all throughout the year. For me, it's very easy to get a hold of me. I'm online on social media, Kambale Musavuli, be it on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. If you go to Kambale Musavuli, I'm there. I'm currently working with the Center for Research in the DRC, studying Kwame Nkrumah, and looking forward to working with individuals and organizations interested in the true liberation of Africa as we take the African continent to new heights.
Thank you. We will have you again to continue this conversation. Listeners, that's all the time we have. You can follow me at Ali Mahdi on Twitter, and please also go to blackstarnews.com. Thank you once again to our guests. Stay well, stay strong, stay Pan-African.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amara Evering with some brief news headlines. Deb Holland, a member of New Mexico's Laguna Pueblo tribe, has become the first Native American person to be the cabinet secretary in U.S. history. The Senate voted 51-40 on Monday to confirm the Democratic congresswoman to lead the Interior Department, an agency that has spent much of its history abusing or neglecting Native American people. The agency will now play a crucial role in the Biden administration's ambitious efforts to combat climate change and conserve nature. Secretary Holland is expected to quickly halt new drilling, reinstate wildlife conservation rules, and rapidly expand wind and solar power on public lands and waters. Jury selection is set to continue today in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer charged with the murder of George Floyd. But there is renewed uncertainty about whether the trial will continue as planned. Chauvin's lawyer yesterday asked the presiding judge to delay the trial and move it outside the city. Chauvin's attorney is arguing that news that the city has settled a $27 million wrongful death lawsuit with George Floyd's family has tainted the jury pool and that his client cannot get a fair trial in Minneapolis. Judge Peter Cahill confirmed that he will consider a postponement and also recall the seven jurors seated last week to ask them what they've heard about the settlement and whether they can still remain impartial in the case. Republicans in Texas have rolled out 24 bills that would make it harder for people to vote in Texas. These measures include restrictions to early voting, more barriers to get and return absentee ballots, require faster purchase to voter rolls, and make it easier to challenge signatures on absentee ballots. Republican Governor Greg Abbott said the state has to, quote, make sure that we reduce the potential for voter fraud in our elections. But Abbott and other Republicans have offered no evidence of widespread voter fraud in Texas. These bills are part of a larger push across the nation in states like Georgia and Arizona to implement new laws to suppress votes. In Georgia, the proposed anti-voter bills would disproportionately hurt black voters, according to an analysis by the Brennan Center. A 21-year-old Michigan man is possibly facing 40 years in prison if convicted for threatening to kill President Biden, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, as reported by authorities. The man, Joshua Doctor, posted comments on social media saying that killing Biden, Pelosi, and Whitmer would be, quote, the catalyst for an American revolution, according to the statement. Authorities said that they also found bomb-making instructions in his phone. Federal agents have arrested two men who were filmed attacking Capitol Police officer Brian Sicknick during the January 6 assault on Congress. George Tanyos of West Virginia and Julian Cater of Pennsylvania appeared in federal court on Monday, charged with assaulting Sicknick and other officers with chemical spray. Sicknick died on January 7th of injuries he sustained during the attack. Separately,